Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Well, thanks for coming along tonight, folks. I've always had a great deal of admiration for Jack Pingleton. As a young boy, I borrowed his book on the Bodyline series from the library and read it. So when some time ago, my brother, out of the blue, saw the Greg Groudon's book and sent it up to me, and I thought it'd be great to have Greg along here tonight. So I'll introduce him very briefly. The topic, of course, is remembering Jack Pingleton. Greg is known to many of you, but he's a Sydney-based sports writer for the Sydney Morning Herald, and he's also an author. And apart from being the chief rugby union writer for the Sydney Morning Herald, he has written 8 books, and his biography, Chuck Fleetwood Smith, which I read some years ago, was widely praised and was described in The Guardian by Frank Keating as being among the 100 best sporting books of the 20th century. And in recent times, Greg has turned his attention to Jack Pingleton and recently published Jack Pingleton, The Man Who Stood Up to Bradman. So welcome here tonight, Greg. Thank you.
Thanks, Jared.
If anyone can't hear, just yell out.
Yep, yeah. Please yell out and I'll scream. First, I'd like to thank the Sydney Institute for giving me the opportunity to talk about a marvellous man. And I don't think we could pick a better day, St Patrick's Day, for a very proud Irishman, as some members of, his family know. Jack Pingleton, probably Australia's greatest, certainly most honest cricket writer, and the most courageous of test opening batsmen, was and always will be a biographer's dream. Then again, what else would you expect from a hard, streetwise reporter? A man tainted and influenced by the Great Depression, who through his sporting ability walked with kings and paupers, but trusted only a few. Forever sceptical, forever probing, a seeker of the truth, he had the ideal way of ensuring that no one ever put anything over him. Jack Pingleton, known to friend and enemy alike as Fingo, became a hoarder. He kept everything. Copies of letters received and sent, articles, clippings, notes, any information that might come in handy when the real history had to be written. Whenever someone disputed him, he would fossick through to find the letter, the note, the whatever which was required to show who was right and who was wrong. He made certain he had the proof. This defence mechanism also had something to do with what happened with his first manuscript. When writing his masterpiece, Cricket Crisis, Jack made one fatal error. Near completing his first draft, he decided to send the manuscript to his former newspaper editor, A.R.B. Palmer, who had agreed to provide advice and guidance. Jack duly sent the manuscript to Palmer in the Army Post. It never arrived. Worse, Jack had forgotten to make a carbon copy. He was shattered, all that work wasted. He would have to start all over again. He learnt an important lesson the hard way. From that day on, Jack made and meticulously preserved carbon copies of every manuscript, letter and note he wrote. Just down the road from where we are assembled tonight is the Mitchell Library. In the bowels of that library lies the secrets to Australia's past, through countless collections, manuscripts and works. In the middle of it all sits the Jack Pingleton papers, without doubt among Australian sport's most important collections. The papers comprise 27 boxes containing Jack's correspondence, notebooks, scrapbooks, pictures and diaries. In addition, there are several rolls of microfilm, which contain his letters over a 60-year stretch, from the early 1920s to just before he died. These letters involved illustrious writers, cricketers, teammates, allies and several prime ministers, who are also friends or enemies of Fingo. One minute you would be reading lush wishes of goodwill from Neville Carters, the next gossip and hot political news from Sir Robert Menzies. Then you'll be given an insight of Australian cricket dressing room altercations with Keith Miller. The next, the ramblings of R.C. Robertson Glasgow, followed by some fun and cheek from Bill O'Reilly. No wonder his colleagues in the Canberra Press Gallery were astounded how Fingland could find enough room in his small, pokey office on the Senate side of the old Parliament House building in Canberra to sit down, let alone have a desk. Such was the enormous clutter constructed around him through piles of newspapers, letters, notes and books heading to the ceiling in all directions. For months, years on my way to work, most mornings I would trudge from Wynyard Station up the hill to the Mitchell Library. I'd walk past here, I reckon, about 4,000 times. For the task of going blind for several hours, deciphering microfilm, personal notes and strange letters. It was an arduous but never painful duty. Delving through the 27 boxes was an endless joy because you discovered the person, his fears, insecurities, passion, needs, triumphs and failures. There was also some great gossip, tremendous off-the-record information about controversial cricketing and political issues, and enough juicy morsels to keep your interest alive because you knew that here were certain truths that required a wider audience. The collection was able to provide the nuts and bolts to what Bill O'Reilly had told me about Jack and that contentious era. For many years, I'd sat next to Bill in the SCG press box as he observed day after day of Sheffield Shield play in the 1980s. Before Tiger would fling open his school exercise book shortly after the tea break to write his latest cricket column for the Sydney Morning Herald, he loved to yarn. He would talk about Bradman, Fingledon, Bodyline, Ashes tours, whatever. And now in those 27 boxes was further proof that whatever Bill said was right. You're also delighted that previous generations, unlike the present, were so eager to preserve something of themselves. It also reminded you that in this immediate internet age, biographers in the not too distant future will struggle to find the primary information. Everything is now cut and pasted, private important correspondence lost with the latest computer crash, and so only crumbs will be left. The art of biography will become an even more arduous, exasperating task. Thankfully, Jack left so much behind so that you could understand the sentiments of John Arlott, cricket's most accomplished radio commentator. Arlott, who shared the BBC microphone on several Ashes occasions, Ashes tours with Fingledon, described Jack as, in quote, he is himself, and a diverse himself it is. How true. Fingledon was himself, a very complex himself, and that diversity was at times overwhelming. Jack is a notable Australian sporting and social identity for various reasons. He was first and foremost a formidable test opening batsman. His first class figures are impressive, tallying 6,816 runs at 44.54 with 22 centuries and 31 half centuries, which included 1,189 test runs. With a rigid defence, an iron will and a refusal to shirk responsibility, Fingledon became the first batsman in history to score four successive test centuries. He was a compiler of runs rather than a composer. He was no great stylist. He didn't smash and grab like the most recent successful Australian opening batsman, Matthew Hayden. He wasn't flashy or flourishing like Arthur Morris. Instead, his batting style was based on a fierce instinct of survival. As he wrote to the English cricket writer Alan Gibson some years after he'd given the game away, "You miss nothing by not seeing me bat. But I could field. I loved it." Surroundings made the cricketer. Having Waverley Oval as his home ground taught him to take no delivery for granted. On this devilishly tricky wicket, deliveries would be at your throat one minute, skidding towards your ankles the next. The natural response was caution. There was no flourishing his back leg. He took the bat back only marginally and, relying on strong wrists and forearms, pushed the ball away from the centre square. He could square cut, drive and glide as well as anyone, but the hallmark of his game was his excellent defence. He was focused on and determined to wear down any bowler he faced. Even more crucially, he was so audacious. He was fearless, prompting both Harold Larwood and Douglas Jardine to remark how courageous he was in the lead-up and during the infamous Bodyline series. Both argued that Fingleton was among the most difficult to get out. He just refused to budge. Their admiration stemmed from Fingleton's brave unbeaten century for New South Wales against England at the SCG just before the 32-33 Test Series began. Confronting intimidating bowling from Bill Vose, Fingleton was hit on the body over and over again. At the end of his innings, across Jack's body were 9 large welts. There were 2 massive bruises on his left knee, 1 just above it, another halfway up his thigh, 1 on his hip where the skin had been cut, a large black bruise on his wrist, 2 more near his heart, and 1 across his right hand. Here and there were smaller bruises, some still bearing stitch mark indentations where the cricket ball had pounded into his body. Several times during the innings he collapsed, one time being assisted to his feet by Jardine, another time by his New South Wales batting partner, Donald Brabham. He was battered, sick to his stomach, but refused to complain publicly. All he would say when probed by his brother Wally, who shared a bedroom with him at their Bondi Junction home, was, quote, "It's unfair, quick cricket." Their mother wasn't so diplomatic. Mrs. Fingleton had arrived at the SCG just before the toss and found a seat in the ladies' stand. She was horrified by England's tactics. In protest, she refused to witness another match, even shunning her son's first test against England the following week in Sydney. Jack ended up playing 18 tests, 12 against England, with the admirable batting average of 42.46. But Jack prided his fielding prowess higher than his batting capabilities. As expected of such a courageous character, Jack loved fielding in close, hovering a few metres away from the batsman at short leg. And he was in his element when his lifelong mate, Bill O'Reilly, had the ball. Fielding in tandem with Victor Richardson, the pair were the masterminds behind O'Reilly's deadly leg trap. As if O'Reilly's wild-spitting medium-post leg spinners weren't enough of a danger to the South African batsmen, Richardson and Fingleton were to perch themselves within the batsman's shadow at forward and short square leg and just hover and take catches. They described it as madman's corner. He produced an abundance of wickets. Fingleton relished playing the psychological game, savouring the nervous twitching of the batsmen as they tried to avoid the edge. O'Reilly was forever grateful. More than a decade after both players had finished their playing careers, O'Reilly sent Jack a copy of his book, Cricket Conquest. On the inside cover he wrote, "To John Fingleton, as a token reparation for the trials and tribulations in the leg trap, a position he filled with great distinction for himself and immeasurable satisfaction for Bill O'Reilly." But where Fingleton was even better than O'Reilly, who was rated by Brabham as the world's greatest bowler, was on the written page. Fingleton's cricketing reputation was enhanced by his writing abilities. He wrote 2 classics, Cricket Crisis and Brightly Fades the Dawn, a cheeky, revealing autobiography, Batting from Memory, and 7 other cricket books. He was also a mighty cricketing journalist for numerous Australian and overseas newspapers, the most notable, the Sunday Times and The Observer in London, where for decades he wrote an obligatory column on the game. What is even more amazing is that he was such an accomplished and learned writer, considering that he was forced to leave school when only 12, following the death of his father, a state Labor Member of Parliament, who died of tuberculosis in 1920. Jack, who was unable to have a secondary school education as he instead had to find work to help feed a fatherless family, was basically self-taught. Unlike so many cricketers who now hover in the media, Fingleton was a journalist before he was an international cricketer. He began as a copy boy when just 14 with the new Sydney Daily Guardian in the 1920s and revelled in the noise and bustle. The rush as reporters grabbed their hats and dashed out after police cars and fire engines. The yelling into telephones, the urgent clatter as they banged away at typewriters, frantic to beat the latest deadline. Jack learnt the media game while on the run. One of Jack's first assignments was hunting down evidence in a murder case in which a victim's body was rumoured to have been stuffed into a luggage trunk. Reporters were sent all over the city in search of the elusive trunk. Fingleton headed immediately towards the rocks area. His colleagues went the other way and instead grabbed a front page scoop when his other colleague succeeded in buying cocaine from a Pitt Street chemist. The reporter was Frank Packer. Finlan did everything in the newspaper office. He did police rounds, court, shipping, gossip columns, industrial rounds. He soon learnt how to ride with bike. He also discovered how to drink. As his cricket career began to gain momentum, Finlan moved to the Daily Telegraph as a general reporter, where he sat near the paper's chief columnist, Lenny Lower. Observing Lower reminded Jack that any writing of note did not come easily. Day in, day out, Jack witnessed through Lenny Lower what Red Smith described as the harsh art of writing. Writing a column is simple, the famed US sports writer would say. You open a vein and bleed. Readers would laugh their way through Lower's daily column, but Jack knew what it cost him to produce. Lower would sit for hours at his desk, glaring into space or painstakingly typing and retyping, every so often ripping the sheet from his typewriter, screwing it into a ball and hurling it to the floor. When he was stuck, he'd go to the pub and eventually stagger back drunk just before deadline to finish the column. Jack took note. Drink before, he told himself, drink after, but never drink while you're writing. And never do a daily column. It's too harmful to your health. He instead decided to cover cricket tours, pursue politicians in Canberra, and freelance for anyone and everyone on anything and everything. He was a genuine journalistic all-rounder, as comfortable writing about sharks for the Argus newspapers in South Africa, covering sharks in the House of Representatives in Canberra, as he was bashing out on his clattering portable typewriter three or four test cricket match reports for various papers at the end of a day's play. However, the prime reason why the name Jack Finlan will remain in the public domain is due to his fractious relationship with Australian sport's most recognisable figure, Sir Donald Bradman. They were colleagues, Australian test teammates during one of the game's most trying times, opponents and vehement critics of each other for well on 60 years. This was no hug and kisses relationship. It involved thorns, pain and deep personal anguish. A frosty pairing that was ignited by numerous controversial events, which to this day are still debated. Right from the start, their relationship was prickly. They first crossed paths in 1929 at the Daily Guardian offices. Bradman, who had just started travelling from Barrow each week to play great cricket in Sydney, was being shown over the paper's offices when he was introduced to Bradman. When he was introduced to Jack. Finlan opted for small talk, telling him about a friend of his who had the makings of a champion cricketer until the day he ran a nail into his foot. Jack said he was left with a stiff right knee. He had tetanus. Bradman immediately corrected him. It was tetanus, Bradman said, with what Jack took to be scorn. Jack took a mental note. This bloke certainly had a high opinion of himself. They soon became New South Wales and Australian teammates. And while obviously overwhelmed by Bradman's incredible cricketing prowess, Jack was not so impressed with Bradman the man. And in the dressing room, Jack was far from being alone. Right from the start, Bradman was different from the rest. He was aloof. He preferred his own company. He was invariably the first to leave the dressing room after play. He was a teetotaler, not seeing the point of drinking or smoking. While his teammates were sharing beer and cigarettes in the room, he would be off writing letters or listening to music in his hotel room. This was also a defence mechanism, as he never really got over all the ribbing he received on his first tour away with the New South Wales team, when he was a victim of numerous hideous practical jokes and treated like a country bumpkin. For Bradman's own well-being, he thought it was best from then on to just stay away from the many ratbags who played with him. That caused further resentment among his New South Wales and Australian colleagues. Many thought Bradman was selfish, that he played for himself rather than the team, and he had no sympathy or interest in anyone else in the team. But as a cricketer, they could not fault him. He was the best, and all acknowledged that. But as a person, he had some disconcerting faults. Jack wrote that Bradman's chief problem with his teammates was that they resented his, in quote, apparent lack of effort to bridge the widening gulf between himself and the rest of the side. They rarely saw him. He was always busy with an engagement here or an appointment there, and practically the only time some of his teammates met him was when he walked with them through the pavilion gates. Who's the stranger? Was the sarcastic quip. Bradman did not make friends easily, nor did he court popularity, end of quote. His teammates were disgruntled that on Ashes tours he would return separately from them to get all the kudos. And in his early days as Australian Test cricketer, Bradman hardly appeased his teammates by staying in a different hotel. Adding to the friction was that Fingleton and the O'Reillys were so different in character to Bradman. The quiet, self-conscious introvert who was happy to be left alone was the polar opposite of the volatile, rambunctious, gregarious Fingleton, and O'Reilly, who both loved a tussle and knew how to hate. O'Reilly said that he and Bradman were as compatible as a cat and a fox terrier. Nestor Tiger said that many times. It wasn't quite like that with Jack and Bradman, but they were hardly pups from the same litter. Bradman and O'Reilly irritated each other because they were so much opposite. Bradman irritated Jack primarily through numerous emotional incidents where Fingleton was convinced the Don had deliberately dudded him. The first revolved around the selection of the 1934 Australian team to play for the Ashes in England. When Jack was left out of the team, even though he was one of the form opening batsmen of that time, he blamed Bradman and told him so. Diplomacy at times was not Jack's best suit. He could be abrasive, infuriatingly forthright, as Bradman discovered some hours after the team was officially announced. Jack was incensed that on the day the team was selected, Bradman had used the pages of Jack's own newspaper, the Sydney Sun, to criticise his running between the wickets in a Sheffield Shield match being played that day. That night, Bradman and Fingleton bumped into each other in the Sun offices. Fingleton shook Bradman's hand and wished him well for the tour. When Bradman replied, "Bad luck," for having been admitted, Jack gave him a piercing look and said, "I think I have largely got you to thank for missing out." Jack never forgave Bradman for missing that tour, believing that Don had convinced the Australian selectors, in particular Bill Woodfull, to pick Bill Brown instead as the opening batsman. Bradman even conceded that was a fact to Fingleton some years later. That didn't make Jack feel any better. Still, this did not cause as much of a ruction as to the dispute over who, during the bodyline test in Adelaide, leaked the infamous quote by Australian captain Bill Woodfull to the England team manager, Pelham Warner. The quote is famous. There are two teams out there. One is trying to play cricket and the other is not. A day or two after that was said, it was in the press. Woodfull's comment ranks as one of the most famous of all sporting quotes, with enormous ramifications, even for some time threatening diplomatic relationships between Australia and England. This comment damning the intimidatory tactics of the England team were under the captaincy of Douglas Jardine. They bowled at the body of the Australian batsmen, who were helpless because of a leg-trap field, came after Woodfull had been hit above his heart from a Harold Larwood delivery at Adelaide Oval. That night, an Australian Test cricketer telephoned the well-known Sydney journalist Claude Corbett in his Adelaide hotel room and said he had important information to pass on. Corbett and his caller met in the cricketer's car, which was parked several kilometres from Adelaide Oval, near the parklands. The cricketer, knowing that he would be immediately detected if any fans wandered past the car, had driven to a secluded spot. There, the cricketer told the journalist what had happened when Warner came to see Woodfull. For Corbett, the journalist, it was a dynamite story. Believing the leak was too hot to keep to himself, Corbett shared it with the other reporters covering the test. The following days, it was headlines all over Australia. And prompted by the controversy, a few days later, the Australian Border Control sent a cable of complaint to the MCC, protesting that England's bodyline bowling was a menace and unsportsmanlike. For the cricketer who leaked the story, it had the desired effect. It put England, whose prime aim was to curb and maim Bradman, on notice. But who had leaked the dressing room conversation? Jack was convinced that Bradman was the leaker. In later years, he repeatedly wrote this as fact, including the account of the North Terrace rendezvous with Corbett. Bradman, rather than suing Fingleton for these claims, preferred merely to insinuate that Fingleton was the culprit. The issue fatally poisoned their already strained relationship. At first, Pelham Warner believed it was Jack, as at the time he was the only full-time journalist in the Australian team. A furious Warner told Larwood he would give him £1 if he could bowl finger it out in the second innings of their late test. Larwood did, and he got the pound. When Warner inferred Fingledon was a leaker in a book written a decade later, Jack went on the warpath. He retaliated in cricket crisis by chastising Warner for targeting him and stating, "I know, as do others, who gave the story out, and unlike Sir Pelham, I can give facts." By then, Jack had those facts straight from Corbett's mouth. Corbett and Fingledon were close friends. Corbett told Fingledon that Bradman told him the story. The links between the Corbetts and the Fingledons were strong. Jack's younger brother, Wally, went to school with Corbett's son, Mac, and as Wally told me, I know exactly who was telling the truth. Wally, a Catholic priest, is also fervently of the belief that Jack and Claude were telling the truth. As Wally said in a recent letter to me only a few weeks ago, quote, "The Don was not the first or the last hero of the public who had some clay between his toes." Gilbert Mant, a journalistic colleague of Corbett's on that Bodyline series, later provided revealing information to renowned cricket writer David Frith. Mant explained that Corbett's daughter Helen had told him that her mother had confided to her that her mother, that her father, it's a bit complicated, that her father had explained, quote, "Bradman had been the culprit, confirming the secret of the after dark meeting as alleged by Fingledon." Nonetheless, Bradman, through the pen of several sycophantic writers, was able to use the issue to vilify Fingledon. Bradman was as adamant that Fingledon was the leaker. Some may think of all this as nitpicking, but for the pair it became an overriding episode. Another cloud hanging over both of their heads was the sectarian issue. Bradman was a Mason. Fingledon, O'Reilly, Stan McCabe were Catholics. Cricket's roots lie deep in Protestant England, and for most of its history in Australia, it revolved around a similar base, with Protestants dominating both on the field and in the administration of the game. So much so that the New South Wales Cricket Association is not believed to have employed a Catholic until the 1970s, more than 110 years after it was formed. There was naturally a feeling among numerous Catholic cricketers that they were looked down upon by those who ran the game. This became a major issue during the 1936-37 Test Series against England, when suddenly during the series, four of the Catholics in the team, O'Reilly, McCabe, Chuck Fleetwood-Smith and Leo O'Brien, were summoned to appear before the Australian Board of Control for supposedly being drunks, slackers, while not giving their full support to the captain, Bradman. Bradman claimed that he had no knowledge of this meeting, and to the players' disgust, refused to attend the hearing where he could have defended them. Instead, he said as he rushed out of the dressing rooms, "It's nothing to do with me. You know how well I get along with the board." The players were incredulous. O'Reilly turned the meeting into a farce when he called it a Spanish Inquisition, and it soon broke up. But the players forever resented that Bradman did not attend that meeting with them, again in their eyes showing that he was a weak, self-centred leader. And O'Reilly, Fingledon and O'Brien were also convinced that Bradman had dobbed his teammates into the board so that they could be ticked off. This just put further acid on the relationship. From then on, O'Reilly did not trust Bradman. Fingledon was forever reticent. Was Fingledon jealous of Bradman the cricketer? No. No one wrote more glowingly about Bradman's sporting conquest. Did Fingledon become over-obsessive about Bradman the man? He has been accused of that. I don't think he was, because he had too broad a range of interests. Irritated? Infuriated, yes. But he had justifiable reasons. Bradman had an overriding influence on his life. Nonetheless, this much publicised and discussed feud should not be treated as the be-all and end-all of Jack Fingledon. It is only part of the rich Fingo tapestry. More importantly, he will always be remembered as a robust, indomitable cricketer and the most marvellous of cricket writers, once described by Sir Robert Menzies as being alongside Neville Carters and E.W. Swanton as the best cricket writer of modern times. My prime hope through this biography is that it will encourage the reader to track down Jack's many marvellous books and discover more about this incredible character. It is well worth the search. Now, as crucially, Fingledon was so instrumental in healing old wounds, especially with Harold Larwood. and reminding all that there was life and bonhomie after Bodiline. Fingleton was influential in getting Larwood to leave England and move to Sydney and a better life in 1950. For the rest of their days, Larwood was indebted to his one-time enemy, Jack Fingleton. As important influence in the Larwood move was the then Prime Minister, Ben Chifley, who, unbeknown to probably the world's greatest pace bowler, had paid half his accommodation bill when he arrived in Sydney after Tom Watson of Tooth Brewery had converted a hotel in Kingsford to accommodate Larwood's large family. When Larwood had settled in, Fingleton invited him to Canberra and organised a meeting with Chifley at Parliament House. Larwood shook Chifley's hand and in his strong Midlands accent said, "Mr Chifley, I'd like to thank you very much for what you've done for me and my family. You've given us a wonderful break in life. We want to express our appreciation to you." Chifley looked at Larwood, then at Fingleton and said, "What did he say, Jack?" Fingleton translated. Chifley replied in his rasping nasal voice, "It's been very nice to have you out here, Harold. I hope you settle down all right. Things go well for you." Larwood looked at Chifley, then at Fingleton, and said, "What did he say, Jack?" Thank you very much for listening, and I appreciate your attention. Thank you.
Many thanks, Greg. There are copies of Greg Grouden's book, Jack Fingleton, The Man Who Stood Up to Bradman, Janet. Grundy's got them outside. $39.95 for the hardback, but I'll probably give it to you for the Special Institute price of $40 if you don't, have the change. If we come to questions, the discussion will finish no later than 7 o'clock. Anne sends her apologies the night she's down court in Canberra. That's been terrific. Can I just ask you about... You, towards the end, you mentioned... by the way, I think there's some members of the Fingleton family here tonight. You're very welcome.
Yeah, they're right. Belinda, Jack's eldest daughter, and Mal Gemmell, who's very important part of this book. Tremendous help.
Well, you're very welcome. You spoke about...
And Jackie.
You spoke about Robert Menzies and Ben Chifley, and you spoke about Jack Fingleton's time in the Press Gallery in Canberra. I remember him as a journalist, essentially. Talk a bit about his politics. As I understand it, he essentially came from that Catholic right-wing part of the New South Wales Labor Party. It's probably not well regarded today as it was then. So he's very much a New South Wales Labor man of a Catholic disposition, but he seemed to have a good personal relationship with the Protestant leader of the Liberal Party, Robert Menzies. So how did that work out? Just come back and talk into the moment.
Okay. No problem. Actually, I might get Belinda and Mal to help me out with these, because they know far more about this part of it than I do. But yes, he was. He was a strict Labor man. His father was a Labor MP who served as the Eastern Suburbs representative for quite a while, so they were strict Catholic Labor. But he became very close to Menzies. But I think also with Menzies, I think the journalist came out of him during that period when he was very close friends with Menzies, because Menzies, as Jack would say, was a very lonely man, and that he would love getting Jack aside after the little press conference they have, just basically to sit there and talk about cricket and whatever. So Jack would sit there and talk away, and then after about half an hour, he sort of, you know, being bored senseless with Menzies' theories on cricket, you'd throw in a couple of political questions and get some great scoops. So I think it was a bit of the journalistic cunning in there, because he was a strong admirer of John Curtin, and he also got on very, very well with Ben Chifley. And Jack's mother was also admired Ben Chifley, and there was this celebrated event at Canberra Airport when Jack's mother went to Canberra to see the family, and I think Menzies had arrived at the airport at the same time, and Menzies and Fingleton were at the airport and Jack's introduced his mother to Menzies, and Menzies made some flippant remark about Jack, and for about 2 minutes, Jack's mother's completely abused Menzies and said, you're nothing compared to Chifley. And then you have the whole interesting, situation where Jack marrying Philippa Street, the daughter of Jessie Street. So that brings even more of a intriguing political tangent to that life.
Well, it's always good to have some representative of the Communist Party in the family. It used to be said that at a certain time in Victoria, of the members of the Communist Party, half went to Geelong Grammar and half came out of the Catholic Church. Right, so Jeff, and then we'll move on. Yeah.
Thanks, Greg, for that talk. Very entertaining, very interesting.
Thank you.
We often hear about this sectarian conflict in the Australian dressing room at the time. How did that manifest itself as distinct from the obvious personality clashes that were going on there?
I don't think it was sort of an unwritten, unspoken thing. I think, you know, when the two groups got together, they said, we're getting a tough time because of the process. But it wasn't spoken about. The interesting thing was wasn't written about till the 70s and 80s. That was the first time anyone really made any point of the fact that there was these sectarian issues, not just in cricket, but in rugby league, rugby union and so forth. But I think it was one of these things that it was when the two clans got together and sort of said, well, you know, we're getting a rough time. But the interesting situation during that period was that a lot of the Catholic players in that team thought the only reason that they got picked because there was a Catholic as one of the selectors, Chappie Dwight, who was a good friend of Bill's and Jack's, and also Wally, Jack's thing. And they always say that if it wasn't for Chappie Dwight, Stan McCabe never would have got picked. And they always thought, well, maybe we never would have got picked. So, but in the dressing room, it wasn't like they were waving crosses at each other. It was just an underlying factor.
So, yeah. I've got no understanding of cricket or body line, but you presented body line something, a really nasty attack on the cricketer. But how was that regarded in England? Did they feel that was in the great traditions of cricket?
Eventually got outlawed, but at the time, the problem they had during the series, well, body line, there's been books written about it, and you bore your senses about it, but in essence, it was basically aimed to thwart Bradman. That was the aim of it, too. Attack the body of Bradman because they thought that Bradman was a slacker. They thought that he was... The English and a number of his teammates didn't think he was courageous under pressure. So that's why they decided to do it. And the problem was at the time that that tour, the 32-33 tour, a lot of the leading cricket writers from England didn't go on the tour. It was sort of, for some bizarre reason, the Cardises and all the established people didn't go on that tour. It was sort of like left to the cable guys. And it took a while for England to be convinced that it was a problem. And in the end, what caused it was that the West Indies, a year or two later, toured England, and Leary Constantine, a few of the West Indian bowlers, deliberately bowled body line at Lord's against England, and suddenly all bets are off. So that, it was the West Indies. They talk about all this other thing, you know, we were talking about the spirit of the game, but it was actually, if you go, the West Indies were very crucial, and Constantine wrote and led to England that actually some people from England put them up to do it to try to thwart body line. So, interesting little aside to that.
Greg, we all know the 1948 Invincibles, that it was captained by Don Bradman. How much was their success due to the calibre of the squad, and how much to Bradman's leadership?
I think there's no doubt that, you know, Bradman was past his best, but undoubtedly you talked to all. You talk to the players of that tour, and they all vouch for how good Bradman was as a captain, except for one, Keith Miller, who had his doubts. But it is interesting that Bill Brown, who was on that tour, always thought that probably the better Australian team was probably the team that went to South Africa, the 35-36 team. He always thought that was probably a better side. And they said that while they were a great team, they took advantage of the England team being rather weaker because of the effects of the war and so forth. So, but Bill Brown always said that, you know, tactically, Bradman was probably the best captain he played against, but the best captain he enjoyed playing was Victor Richardson because it was a party. So,
John.
Greg, I'm historical and I'm particularly just combining Jack Pingleton's later relationships with the researchers, did you find Inwood, Robert Menzies actually formed a view about what happened to the court incident? He would have heard from Pingleton that if anyone knew all the personalities that were involved, both at team level and administration level, it was Menzies. And it would have been, I presume, of some interest to him as to what that story was. Now, officially, Menzies always praised Bragg as Australia's greatest cricketer. But did you find in that suggests that he ought to be about that?
Nothing.
What is it now do you see as being the balance in terms of about who it actually in fact is?
Leave the court there. Menzies first. Menzies was actually at that bodyline test in Adelaide. He was in the crowd. In my research, which went through all, there was quite a lot of letters between Menzies and Jack, both in the collection at the Mitchell Library and also in the library in Canberra, the Menzies collection. No direct reference to that Corbin incident. But there was a number of occasions where Jack passed, sort of would ask Menzies for his opinion about something he'd written about Bradman in his books. And Menzies always erred on the side of caution, would say, no, tone it down. You don't need to be so castigating of Bradman. But on that case, no, nothing directly on Corbett, nothing concrete there at all. Read the infamous quote in the leak. For a long while, Jack was getting blamed for the quote. Everywhere you read it was Pingleton. But I'd say in the last 10 years that has changed abruptly, because I think quite a number of people now started to properly research the situation. When I was doing the Chuck Fleetwood Smith book, I know Tiger helped me heavily doing that, and he gave me a lot of information. And I also got to know Leo O'Brien very well, and there was quite a lot of information that Leo O'Brien told me which I wasn't allowed to print to after he'd died. I wasn't allowed to put it in the Fleetwood Smith book, but I was allowed to put it in the Bradman book. And there's a couple of things there, because Leo O'Brien was the man in the actual dressing room when the quote was, when Woodfull said that thing. He was the person in the dressing room. And I'm delighted to say that he wouldn't tell me who he thought it was, but he said, you know who it is. And I said, okay. But he did also verify the fact that the Board of Control meeting in 36, 37, when the four Catholics had to appear before the Board of Control, he said, because Leo O'Brien was very close to the Melbourne representatives of the Board of Control, he had strong Victorian Cricket Association links, and so forth. And he vowed that he was told by the officials of the time and that he had seen the actual records which said that Bradman was the instigator of that meeting. But just on that situation, I think most people now are of the understanding that it was Bradman who leaked that quote. I think a crucial change was David Frith's book, The Bodyline Autopsy, which I'd recommend anyone in this room to read, because it's a fantastic book, not just on cricket, but of that whole era. And he did a lot of research into that situation, and he was helped by Gilbert Mant, the journalist on that tour, who did his own investigation and got hold of Corbett's daughter, who vouched for the fact that it was Bradman who leaked the quote. And also in my research, I had got to know Jack's brother Wally, who is still alive. He's a fantastic character, and he was a very, very good friend of Corbett's son Mac, and also attended Claude Corbett just before he died, and he's also of the same opinion he's adamant that it was Claude Corbett is correct and had told him that Bradman was the man. So I think it's changing. I think now people are starting to look more realistically at Bradman and looking at him at last as a three-dimensional character rather than a two-dimensional character. And you know, you've got to understand with Bradman, he was a politician, he had flaws.
Leave it at that. Michael.
After Pingo had got dumped for Bill Brown, what sort of writing did Ingleton have about Brown's performances? Did you have a look at any...
What he did about Bill? Yeah.
And one, a double question, if I may. In the Ingleton-Bradman contretemps, did either of them ever use the ultimate penalty in cricket and run the other out?
That's a good question. That's a good question. First up, move Bill Brown. No, the interesting thing was with Jack, during that period when he was playing, he deliberately wrote about... He did mainly general journalism. He very rarely wrote about cricket, or if he did, he'd make certain it was so oblique that it... But he deliberately... I went through all his writing, and I cannot see him writing about Bill Brown or being critical of Bill Brown. And the interesting thing is that even though Bill took his spot on that tour, Jack and Bill became the closest of friends. They were great mates, and that was one of the great thrills of doing this book, was actually going to see Bill Brown in Brisbane a few weeks before he died, and talking about that relationship they'd had. And Bill, you know, Bill always was a little bit embarrassed that he took Jack's spot, but you know, they even talked about it, because a few years later they went on that South African tour together, and they talked about it, and Jack said, "No, I don't resent you getting the spot. It wasn't you who did it, you know." And they became very, very good friends. So
Brown was still playing after the war, though.
Yes, that's right. Now, he wrote about him in his books, but he never, in his books, he never actually was critical of Bill Brown as a player. I think he was too smart to get caught in that one. And Bradman running out Fingal or vice versa. That's a good question. I don't think so, but Mary, have you heard that one, or Belinda? No, I don't think
so. I think if it happened, I think Bradman might have mentioned it.
Yeah, I think so. Or they would have been, either one would have mentioned it. Yeah.
So Ingleton's playing period was, well, before most of us were around, and our only real contact has been when Michael Parkinson rediscovered him in that fantastic couple of interviews, which ended in that great climax with the ties. Would you like to make any comment on those interviews?
Yeah, no, you are right. That's Jack was sort of... It was fantastic that Michael sort of introduced Jack to the Australian audience, and there was reasons why Jack wasn't known to Australian audience, because he did most of his writing for overseas papers because they paid him better, and he didn't like the Australian newspaper prize because they thought there were a bunch of mingy blokes that paid crap to their journalists, which is true. So he would, you know, that's why he wrote fantastic stuff for the Sunday Times, which he didn't see. Then he was working for the Observer and so forth. But when Jack was working for the Sunday Times, he developed a friendship with Michael Parkinson, who was a sports writer. As usual with Jack, he was a bit suspicious of Parkinson first up, but they became very, very good friends. And when Parkinson first came over to Australia, his first time, he tracked down Jack and said he'd like to have him on these TV shows. And there was, before the first TV show, there was this famous incident at the press club in Canberra where Parkinson was the guest speaker, and Fingleton was in the crowd, and for most of the day asked him crazy questions and ridiculed him and so forth, and basically, you know, threw Parkinson, and there was these marvellous correspondence between the two about the two of them having this great thing. And you are right, his appearances on that show were tremendous, and the famous one when he was on with Bill, Bob Hawke and Kate Fitzpatrick, where Jack showed his, you know, natural wit, but also being able to turn around and get Bob Hawke to admit that he was about to join federal parliament. He, you know, on the Parkinson show, he was able to get the scoop, so he showed his journalistic nous as well. So, there's a couple of funny stories about those appearances on the Parkinson show, and I probably get this wrong, I have to check, but I think the first show he had problems with his teeth on it. Can you remember? Or you know what I'm talking about? Okay. Yeah, he was worried that his teeth were going to fall, so he glued his teeth into his mouth. They had major problems just before the show with his mouth, but it all turned out well. And then there was another one where he was worried. Just before he appeared on the show, this is when he was in the BBC and he had a bit of the fruitcake. He thought he was going to choke and die on the show because he thought he was going to think. So, yeah, you are right. The Parkinson influence is very, very important in giving Jack a greater identity in his final years.
How much did these Catholic blokes drink? I mean, Fleetwood Smith obviously drank a lot, but what about Brian Fingleton, McCabe? Were they O'Reilly? Were they very heavy drinkers? Or?
Not enormous drinkers. Jack was not an enormous drinker. Probably Tiger was the. No, they weren't. They weren't. They liked a beer, but it wasn't out of control. It wasn't as if they were, like the last 10, 20 years. Yeah. But the interesting with Jack was, I think it was with Tiger. Tiger, when he first started as a cricketer, was a teetotaler. And it was, I think it was Clary Grimmett or Stan McCabe. And there's a fantastic chapter in Tiger's autobiography about the importance of drinking beer. And it was one of them saying, you've got to have a midi of beer after a day's play to get your sustenance back. And Tiger wouldn't be into it until he had it, and then the next day I think he got four wickets. From then on, he was sold. So he got onto it. So, and actually, the great thing about Tiger when he was doing his column for the Herald in his latter years, he always used to at the cricket ground. He always used to get invited to the SCG Trust every day. The SCG Trust were hassling him to join or see all the dignitaries in the trust room. And every day he would refuse. He would rather be with us down in the Minji dining room with all the journos, because they used to give us these beautiful cold glasses of mini beer at lunch. So I used to have two of them for lunch, and that was his thing. He always said that just before lunchtime, some sort of distinguished guy from the trust would walk up and say, "Mr. O'Reilly, would you be available to attend the trust lunch today?" And he'd say, "Son, I'd rather eat a hot meat pie with my mates." So, no, they weren't mate, massive drinkers. No.
So, I think there was we'll go to Ross. The Irish writer, because St. Patrick's Day, we can say this, the Irish writer Flann O'Brien said the brain was best viewed as a sponge, that provided you drank, you'd keep it moist, but if you didn't drink, it'd crack and you wouldn't last long. It's like the O'Reilly theory. Ross.
Fred, whose life was most affected by the feud?
Oh, no doubt, Jack. I think Jack, no doubt, because, and I think for obvious reasons, because it affected him far more than Bradman. Like, Bradman voted on, and Jack, missing that 1934 tour was really, really upset Jack, because, there was this incredible letter, which is in the book that he writes with Bill Woodfull, and it was just the hurt to his family, and it really gutted him, and because he seriously thought he should have been on that tour. And that was the core of the anger towards Bradman, because he always blamed Bradman for, whispering into Woodfull's ear that Bill Brown's a better player. And then it sort of affected him in the 1938 tour, and he writes about it. Jack got picked for the 1938 England tour, and he said, "Well, I'm making up for lost time." So he decided to go to the House of Parliament. He used to go to the theatre, and he wanted to see everything. And they said it affected his cricket, that 1938 tour, because he thought he should have been there in 1934. And then if he was there in 1934, he would have been in 1938. So, but the great thing about Jack was that he used that 1938 tour to his benefit. He spent days at the House of Parliament, made certain he saw England, and with him and Lindsay Hassett, they disappeared over to Ireland for about a week and had a good time.
Yes.
All right. I don't know anything about cricket, but does a cricket captain have to be a leader? Because it seems that Bradman is no way a leader like Napoleon or Alexander the Great, the man who inspires his men, whose men love him and follow him, forever.
Well, there's been some pretty ordinary leaders of men been great cricket captains, but you can't get away with it because it is a pretty individual sport. It's a great individual sport in a team environment. But it's conflicting. A lot of people do say that a lot of the teammates, you've talked a lot of the 1948 team, there's not too many of them left, and they all rate Bradman as a leader. Particularly that time when he was a lot older, like he was at the end of his career, he was 40, and he was a father figure to them. And he, on that tour, he was a father figure to him. Earlier, when he was captain in the mid-late 30s, he was younger than a lot of the players, and he had a bit of an inferiority complex about the players. So at that time, he wasn't as good a leader. At the end of his career, you can understand why he was, you know.
We're getting near the end, Michael.
You mentioned Fleetwood Smith. His nickname, Chuck, was that because of his bowling action? Or his
Chuck Fleetwood Smith was a complete lunatic, and it was a childhood name given to him by his parents. He grew up in Stawell, and his parents were well-to-do. People were trying to they ran the local paper. They thought they were the bush aristocracy. And it was like the whole thing about Chuck Fleetwood Smith, a lot of it was doctored. They changed his age, they bodged his name, made him a hyphenated name. His name was just Chuck Smith, but I could talk for hours about Fleetwood Smith. But Chuck was a name that he got as a kid from his parents.
He was a serious drinker, wasn't he?
He ended up in Darrow. He ended up sleeping under the Flinders Bridge in Melbourne. So yes, he was a Darrow.
Oh, very sad. Just a final question. Tell us a bit about Jack's wife. I mean, obviously she was an important influence on his life and perhaps on his career.
Jack's wife Pip, it was a you could understand. It was a hard life for Pip because she grew up in a very privileged early life with her mother and Kendall Street, who was in the Chief Justice of New South Wales. And then suddenly when Jack first saw Pip on the boat going to the Ashes Tour in 1938, that Pip was with her mother and they were going on this grand tour of the world and through Europe, and Jesse was doing speeches at various peace conventions and so forth, and Pip was she was about to start university and decided to go on this big tour, and Jack met Pip on the boat, and they developed a romance on the boat, and then they met each other later on, and it went from there. But Jack, a lot of Jack's success you have to give to Pip, because Pip was one minute was in this magnificent lifestyle, and suddenly she's been shuttered to Canberra by herself to bring up a large family, and she did. She was very, very, very supportive of him during the early part of his writing career, and she was the one who kept the family going when Jack was going away on tours, and when they first went to Canberra, there was not much there. Yeah. Not much there at all. So, Philip is a very, very important part of the Fingerland story.
Many thanks. Take a seat.
Thank you.
Well, I'll be very brief. We've had a great night. It's a great story. There are not many figures in Australian history who made such an important contribution, both in sport and in journalism. I mean, Richie Beno did, but there weren't many of them, and Jack Fingleton was one of them, whose contribution was probably equally important across both fields. So, look, Greg Groudon has written an important and timely biography. And we thank you for coming here tonight to talk about remembering Jack Fingleton. Well done, Greg. And as I said, Janet Grundy's got some copies outside, and I'm sure the author would be happy to sign them. But for now, that's it. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.